Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Bernie Madoff masterminded a Ponzi scheme so vast it sucked in billions, and before it all fell apart, made him a Wall Street icon. Then, in the meltdown of 2008, Madoff's scheme melted down too. Fraud exposed, billions lost, suicides. Bernie Madoff went to jail, a 150-year sentence. New York Times reporter Diana Henriquez followed him in, tracked down all the details. Now she's telling the whole story. This hour on Point, Bernie Madoff, wizard of lies. You can join the conversation. What's your question on what he did and how he did it? How do you look at Bernie Madoff now? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Diana Henriquez, senior financial writer for the New York Times. She's led the Times coverage of the Madoff scandal, and right after his guilty plea went after the jailhouse interview. She got it first and more than once, and she got a whole lot more. Her new book is The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. Diana Henriquez, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here, Tom.
Describe for us where Bernie Madoff sits right now.
Well, he sits in a small, medium-security prison in the eastern shore of North Carolina, not far from Durham. It's a relatively modern facility. He shares a room with one other inmate. They're kind of room-like cells. He works in the commissary. He reads a lot. I think he's bored, but he's certainly adapting, it seems to me, to prison life.
How does his room now compare to his room in the heyday of his Ponzi scheme?
I think his dressing room was larger than his cell right now.
And you've seen him there. And you've seen him there more than once. I guess describe those two times that you've sat with him in the prison there in North Carolina.
Yes, Tom. It took about 18 months to organize the first of my visits, which was in August of last year. I started writing Madoff, as you said, as soon as he was locked up here in Manhattan after his guilty plea. Did not even get a response from him until the fall of 2009. When he sent me a handwritten letter at home saying, you know, he knew my career, respected me, but it was just not the right time for him to talk. I kept at it. I kept sending letters, making my argument that he owed an explanation to history, that I wanted to be as fair as possible to him. And eventually, in the late spring of last year, his lawyer started to indicate that I might be able to get through. Then it required a great deal of paperwork on the prison side. Step one is to get the prisoner to agree to see you, and step two is to get the warden to agree to let a media member in. That took a bit longer, but we finally did, and I sat down with him in August down at the prison visiting room.
On your first meeting, you describe him as a pretty cool, collected customer. The second meeting, not so much.
Oh, there was an amazing difference, Tom, between those two meetings. Crisp was sort of what came to my mind when I first met him. He looked a lot different than he did, of course, as this very well-groomed, well-dressed man on the, in Manhattan. But he seemed very healthy, and he had a great command of himself, a little bit of humor, a little bit of flattery, very much the plain-spoken, accessible Bernie Madoff that I had known back in his prior life on Wall Street. And then in February, when I went back to see him, I was shocked. He had lost a great deal of weight. His uniform was badly pressed. Actually, Tom, there was a button unbuttoned halfway down his shirt that he didn't even notice until halfway through our interview. He was always such an immaculate man that struck me very heavily as a sign of how upset and really disheveled his thinking had become after the death of his son, Mark.
Of course, between those two interviews, his son, Mark, one of his two sons, committed suicide in December, not long before your February interview. Was that the thing that set him back? Was it time in prison? Was it a realization of how much loathing is out there for him?
I think it was more Mark's death than the time, really. And as to the loathing that he inspires, Tom, I really think he is so well defended against that. I mean, people frequently ask me, well, did he show remorse? Did you sense remorse in him? And although he says the words, what I really get the strongest impression of is denial. When he talks about the damage he caused, he invariably, whether in an email, a letter, or in my two interviews with him in prison, invariably couches it in terms of dollars and cents. Here's how much the trustee might recover for the victims. Here's how much they made for me over the years, and so forth. There's never an acknowledgement, as you said, of the suicides, the bereaved families, the beloved homes that had to be sold, the college educations that got derailed, the businesses that were ruined, the human wreckage. There's never an acknowledgement of that. And indeed, he had sent me about three or four emails in December after Mark's death before he even, with one sentence, acknowledged my condolences, which I had expressed, of course, as soon as as Mark had died.
Here's that sound. We've all seen the picture of him on the street in Manhattan. This is a week after his arrest, December 2008. This is Bernie Madoff facing a mob of reporters and photographers, one of whom pushed him in the sort of scrum there as he was returning to his apartment after a judge placed him, Bernie Madoff, under house arrest.
Mr. Madoff, what do you have to say for yourself? What do you have to say to the public, to your investors?
Don't push me is all he had to say there. Diana, take us back. When did this start? You've covered this and covered it and covered it. When did Bernie Madoff's incredible fraud begin?
Well, you know, what I think I would like to say is which fraud, Tom? Because in my research, I think I really started to understand Madoff better when I kind of freed myself from the notion that there was one single big crime that he had committed. In the book, I describe an incident in 1962. He had just been in business for a couple of years, very young man. He started his business when he was still in college, and he got in trouble.
What was his business in those days, Diana?
He was an over-the-counter stock trader.
Okay.
And the over-the-counter market back in those days bears no resemblance to what anyone would recognize as a stock market today. It was a dealer market. It conducted on telephones and backroom trading. These were the stocks that were too unseasoned or small to be listed on the big board. Mm-hmm. He made a business, as did thousands of young brokers, made a business trading those stocks among themselves for customer accounts. And he had perhaps a couple of dozen family members, friends, neighbors who were investing money with him and letting him manage their investments in the over-the-counter market. And he did a dreadful thing. He invested their savings. These are all small savers, conservative people. He invested their savings in these wild new issues in the over-the-counter market. I've likened them to the technology bubble stocks of the 1990s, you know, flimsy little companies. Mm-hmm. Some might survive, some might not. He should never have put their savings in an investment like that. And sure enough, the stock market hits an air pocket in 1962. We don't even remember it now, but at the time it was devastating, the worst anybody'd seen since the Great Depression. And all of those stocks just cratered. Well, Madoff, rather than saying, I blew it. I'm sorry. Bad judgment. I'm awfully sorry. Covered it up. He bought those shares back out of his clients' accounts at their original price. It took all the money he had made in more than 2.5 years in business. He borrowed from his father-in-law to recapitalize his firm, and he never told any of his customers what had happened. So they thought he was a genius. He had maneuvered through this awful market without costing them any money.
So he made them good. He kept them whole, but he did it through a fraud. I mean, he was borrowing and he was lying. He wasn't telling the truth about what had happened.
Absolutely. And we've got to wonder. I think we can both speculate if he had told the truth then. Would anybody have ever thought he was the genius that he later was seen as, and people were so eager to trust him with their money? Was that kind of a turning point? But there we have a point. A young man, early in his life, he was at an intersection between telling the truth and telling a lie that would preserve his reputation and preserve his pride and avoid having to admit failure. Mm-hmm. And he took a turn toward the lie.
And it worked for him then, and he found himself back in. Now, you're very clear in pointing out that he always had more than one business going on. And in some of them, he was genuinely successful, not fraudulently, apparently successful.
Right. Right, he did. And it was that business that I got to know him in fact, Tom.
What was that?
Well, he had a wholesale stock trading business, which means he didn't take customer orders from folks like you and me. He took orders from folks like Merrill Lynch and Fidelity and Charles Schwab. They would route their customers' orders through his trading firm. He was a wholesale trader. And he developed software and computer speed and technology that allowed him to trade stocks very fast. And he could do it much more cheaply than other places, so he attracted a lot of business. And it was that business that he built up that really made his reputation on Wall Street. He was a pioneer in stretching the boundaries of stock trading. The New York Stock Exchange would close at 4:30. Bernie's trading desk would stay open and trade all night long. So when I was a younger reporter at Barron's Magazine, and news would break in the afternoon about big board company like General Electric, let's say. I'd call Bernie's trading desk and I'd say, what's the stock doing?
They'd be open. I mean,
yeah, and they would be trading that stock with people all around the world. So Madoff was one of the first to see that stock trading was going to become a 24/7 global activity and organized his firm to exploit that and to take advantage of that.
But on the other side of the business, he was pulling in money from, 20,000 victims or something like that in the end, and spinning it a complete fiction, the returns they were getting there, paying some with what others were pumping in.
Absolutely. It's important to understand, though, I've had a lot of people confused about how much money they made. We can talk about that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Bernie Madoff story, the man in jail, his massive fraud, and how he did it, with Diana Henriquez, reporter for The New York Times, who has followed Bernie Madoff for years. She has interviewed him in the jailhouse in North Carolina, in the prison, lots of interaction, and tracked down many, many others as well. She had the first interview with Bernie Madoff in prison. She's out with a new book. It's called The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. Diana Henriquez joins us from New York. She had it first. A couple of others have slipped in there since and had conversations with Bernie Madoff. Here he is this past winter. This is taped from a phone conversation he had with New York Magazine's Steve Fishman, saying that this is Bernie Madoff's voice from prison, saying he originally thought he could get out of his own Ponzi scheme.
I mean, you know, you say to yourself, all right, all of a sudden these banks, which wouldn't give you the time of day, some of them all of a sudden are willing to, you know, give you $1 billion. They said, we're going to start a fund, you know, but we need you to commit to the money. So I said, okay, I think I can do it. Because I thought that even if I started to short some of this stock to them, it would just be a matter of, you know, weeks or then months, and, you know, I'd be able to recover from it.
But so interesting, in the same note with you, Diana Henriquez, these banks that wouldn't give you the time of day, they're suddenly coming to Bernie Madoff. And what was driving him? You say he never wanted to admit failure. He just couldn't bear it. But also it seems to me that maybe he knew he was on borrowed time here, but he loved being the super big shot so much he couldn't give it up.
Well, he certainly does have an ego. There's no doubt about that, and you could see that in that section.
Yeah.
But you also heard something else in that account, Tom, which is this ability to rationalize what happened to him, to always come up with an explanation for why he did what he did. I don't doubt that he's been able to rationalize it to himself, but it's a little hard for me to believe that he slipped into this fraud as suddenly as he claims. There was a cash crisis that he experienced in 1987 in the aftermath of the stock market crash then, when his biggest investors started to pull money out. And he told me in the August visit that that upset him greatly. I could tell it was. He was still angry about it, that he thought he had an agreement that they would let their profits roll over and that they would not make these big withdrawals, and suddenly they did. And he was having trouble meeting their withdrawals. Now, that doesn't make sense if he was legitimately investing their money at that time.
Right.
But as luck would have it, that's when the great hedge fund boom started, and he was able to tap in to that boom. That's what he was referring to there, banks who want to give you this, you know, $1 billion fund. Those were the hedge funds that came knocking at his door with this spigot of cash that just started gushing out. And I confronted him in my conversation. I said, wasn't it a temptation right at the time when you were being stressed with these big withdrawals to take that money that was pouring in the door and just make the withdrawals with that. Oh, no, he insists. He did not start the Ponzi scheme until 1992. I don't find that credible. I think it is far more likely that it had begun at least by the 1980s. I wanted to get back to something we'd said earlier mm-hmm. about the returns that he was earning. I think a good way to think about the Madoff fraud in that hedge fund environment is to realize that for most of the time that he was conducting this fraud, his investors actually could have made much more money in legitimate public investments.
There were times when it wasn't the giant return they were coming for. They were coming for that steady, almost unbelievably, truly unbelievably steady payout.
Exactly. And I almost think that we need to call that kind of fraud something different from a Ponzi scheme. A Ponzi scheme has always been thought of as something that exploited our greed, you know, 50% a month, you know, get rich overnight. That's what we think of as the classic Ponzi scheme. I think this is a new species of fraud. I think it's a scheme that exploits our fear of volatility, our fear mm-hmm. of losing our principal. And what worries me, Tom, is that as the markets have gotten more and more complicated and all of us are more and more responsible for managing our own 401k
and maybe
looking
more
out
afraid.
For our retirement and much more afraid, we're going to be even more vulnerable to the soft, calming voice of a guy like Bernie Madoff who says, listen, I can make this simple for you. We don't need to chase those very high returns. I'll just pay you a nice, steady rate of return. And we're going to be very vulnerable to the next Bernie Madoff because of that.
We'll talk about what might be done to avoid that. We've got lots of questions from listeners. Diana Enriquez is with us. Her new book is The Wizard of Lies. James is calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, James. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much. Just a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
Did Diana reveal the title of the book to Bernie during the preparation process? And do you think Bernie was aware of the context of the book in terms of some of its somewhat negative perspectives?
That's a great question. Did he know that you were going to dub him the Wizard of Lies, Diana? Did he hear your angle coming?
I was very candid with him that I was going to be as fair as I could be to everybody, but I was going to call it as I saw it. He had absolutely no advance review of the book. We've sent him a copy if the prison lets it through, but until then, he will not know what. Until he reads it, he won't know what was in it. He did hear the title of the book after my interview with him in February was published in
How
the New
he
York
hear it?
Times. He read it in the New York
oh,
Times.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And
the forthcoming
he didn't like
Wizard
it.
Of Lies.
Yes.
How did he let you know that he didn't like it?
He sent me an email. Mm-hmm. It was waiting for me as soon as I surfaced from all of the deadline pressures that day. He thought it was way too sensationalistic. So I wrote him back and I said, Bernie, you must have known that any book about your crime was going to include the word lies somewhere. You know, but he didn't like it. And I don't know that he will like the book. I doubt it.
One would kind of hope not.
One would kind of hope not. The one
Please.
Thing I did.
20 billion gone, 60 billion right. gone, a lot of lies under the bridge and a lot of people hurt.
Yeah, I think one thing that he will be somewhat gratified about is that I do recount his legitimate career on Wall Street, and he was very concerned that I do that. I was one of the few people who approached him to talk to him who had actually known him before. I'd known him as something other than just the world's greatest crook. So I think he felt like I might at least understand how important he'd been in a legitimate way to Wall Street before this ghastly crime started.
Let's get a call from Columbia, South Carolina. And Jim, hi, Jim. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What's your question, Jim?
My question is, I was reading the excerpt from your guest book on the New York Times website, and there was one part in there about a $6 million loan for Mr. Madoff to one of his sons to buy a beachfront home on, I believe, Nantucket Island.
Yes.
As the trustee is trying to recover the money and everything, I wonder if he's also going after real estate. Like, whatever happened to that home, because it was clear to me, at least, that the purchase was made with someone else's money.
That's a great question, Jim. Thanks for raising it. Diana, there's a lot to unpack there about what the bankruptcy trustees are doing, and I want to talk about that. But take us back for just a moment to that incident that Jim describes, where it's getting very late in the game here. His son wants to buy a beautiful new house on Nantucket. He's come to Pops for some money, $6 million, You write that Bernie, you know, his image won't allow him to say no. He can hardly say, oh, I can't afford to loan you $6 million or give you $6 million. He's supposed to be super rich. How did that all unfold, Diana?
Well, he had been the family piggy bank for decades. Everyone in the family expected to be able to draw on their commissions to get loans from the company, and so this was a routine request, really, from Mark and his wife to get a loan from Bernie as opposed to going to the bank to buy this home. And it certainly would have spread alarm if Madoff had said, no, I can't spare the money right now. I think this is one of the arguments that I find persuasive about the conclusion that his immediate family, Ruth, Mark, and Andrew, did not know
wife and two
that he
sons.
Was conducting. Yes, that he did not know he was conducting this fraud. In answer to the other back end of that question, yes, indeed, the trustee is going after real estate. He's going after security investments. Nothing was too small. He canceled the magazine subscriptions at the firm and got refunds from them. He canceled insurance policies.
This is Irving Picard, the bankruptcy trustee, who's going back and now exactly what is he doing? He's dragging back. You know, some people lost everything. Some people made money with Bernie Madoff. Is the trustee going to those who had payouts from Madoff and asking for all of that back, or what they made on top of whatever they put in?
This is one of the most controversial parts of this case, Tom, and it's going to be one of the most heartbreaking aspects of this case going forward. I mean, that's the brutality of a Ponzi scheme. It doesn't just transfer wealth from a victim to a villain. It transfers wealth from one victim to another victim, and somehow it's got to be sorted out afterwards. The trustee believes he's following standard practice and well-established law by requiring that step one is to get everybody back on a level playing field so that they at least have their initial cash investment back.
Is that likely to happen? Is he on track to do that? In other words, you would get back dollar for dollar what you had put in. Does that look like a likely outcome?
I would have said a year ago, oh, don't be silly, Tom. Now I have to say, you know, he actually might. He just might. It's been not only the most remarkable Ponzi scheme ever, it's been the most remarkable Ponzi scheme recovery effort.
In other words, he's headed toward recovering something like $20 billion, I think, is the total that was put in. Not what was promised back out on paper, but what was actually put in.
Yes. For the people who had never taken anything out, he does appear to be on track of at least having a chance of paying them back the dollars they put in. Now, that's absolutely stunning. There was a Ponzi scheme that surfaced the other day that everyone was bragging about, saying, look what a great return we got. So unusual for a Ponzi scheme. We're paying people back 27.5 cents on the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
but that's
here
not
we
the
are.
Madoff case. He's going for much more than that, Irving Picard.
Absolutely. In fact, the betting on Wall Street right now, where these claims trade in a speculative market, betting on Wall Street right now is that they are worth at least 75 cents on the dollar, because people think that they will actually recover more than that. So that's just the net losers, as they're called. Those are the people who never took anything out. The net winners who did take out as much as they put in and then more so are in a grievously painful position. And
how much is being dragged back from them?
Well, as much as the trustee can from those who can afford it. He has set up a hardship program so that those who have lived off their Madoff profits and do not have great wealth can be exempted from what this process, this clawback process, as it's called. So there is a hardship program in place that I know he hopes more people will take advantage of if they're eligible for it. But for the big guys, the big hedge funds, the big bankers who took out billions and billions of dollars in the last 90 days, the last year of the fraud, he's going all around the world to try to get that money back.
Do you know, is it public record yet, what his biggest chunks of clawback are at this point? How much from whom?
Yes, it is. The biggest piece of money he's actually put in the bank in terms of cash came from a mysterious Palm Beach investor named Jeffrey Pickauer. Pickauer had been one of Madoff's biggest investors, one of his supposedly closest friends, and had withdrawn an enormous amount of money from his Madoff accounts over the years. His widow, Barbara, in December, wrote a check for $7.2 billion back to the trustee, returning all of the money that her husband had withdrawn from his Madoff accounts. That money is the bulk of what Picard has available. He's reached out of court settlements with others, Palm Beach philanthropist Carl Shapiro and his family, a private Swiss banker, Spanish bank hedge fund group. So
Shapiro was a very wealthy garment maker, entrepreneur. How much on the dollar of what he took out has he paid back?
Well, we have less information about the Shapiro case because Shapiro was never actually sued by the trustee. He settled the case before he had been sued for well more than $500 million, something around $600 million. And that money now is being made available to the spy money for victims.
Do you know what percentage of his net take out of the Madoff fund that constitutes?
We don't, but I do know how Picard is negotiating these out-of-court settlements. And it comes down to, it sounds almost crass to say it, but how much are we going to let you keep? When he's sitting across the table from someone who took out hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, the question isn't, how much are you going to give us back?
Mm-hmm.
The question is, okay, we're going to take everything except how much?
And the house on Nantucket that went to his son, or that he
sold? Oh, sold. All of the real estate has either been sold or being sold. The trustee is still negotiating a financial settlement with the surviving son, Andrew, and with the estate of Mark Madoff and with Ruth Madoff. They're still negotiating the return of virtually all of their assets to this pot that can be used for victims, but that will certainly happen. The boats have been sold. The jet has been sold. The townhouse in France, the ocean-going yacht, the private plane. So all of those assets, right down to literally Ruth's yoga clothes, were sold at auction to raise money for victims.
Mary in New London, Connecticut. You're on the air with Diana Henriquez. Thanks for calling, Mary.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of quick questions. One would be Ruth Madoff. In your research, were you able to figure out what Ruth might have known and at what point she knew about this scheme?
And give us your second question as well, Mary, and we'll deal with them both.
Thank you. My second question is, what is Ruth's life like today?
Can we go to the second one first, Diana, and hold the what she knew and when she knew it for after the break, because it's coming right up here. But what is Ruth's circumstance today? Where? How's she living? What's her life like?
She's living in a very quiet seclusion in Florida. She is still close to her sister who lives there, even though her sister and brother-in-law were her husband's victims. They have been kind to her. She does volunteer work. She's an extremely private person, and this has been very difficult for her, I know, from my confidential research. And, of course, Mark's death was every mother's nightmare. It was just devastating for her.
And the other son, Andrew?
Andrew seems to be a little stronger. He had already begun kind of a separation from his dad's firm after Andrew's battle with cancer in the mid-2000s. And so I don't think he was as invested in this identity of being Bernie Madoff's son as Mark was. I mean, Mark was the proudest thing in Mark's life was that he was Bernie Madoff's son, and suddenly, overnight, that source of his greatest pride became that source of his greatest shame. And those who knew him and cared deeply about him think it just broke his heart and he just couldn't bear it.
Is Ruth Madoff still rich?
Well, no.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the Bernie Madoff story, the man in jail, his massive fraud, how he did it, with Diana Henriquez, reporter for the New York Times, covered Bernie Madoff for years, has covered his scandal inside and out, and the first jailhouse interview with Bernie Madoff, and more following that. Her new book is The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. Here's a little bit more of tape. This is, again, from Steve Fishman's New York Magazine interview with Bernie Madoff in prison in North Carolina. You can hear him spinning the suffering he's inflicted, pointing out the money he made for clients through his trading business, the money that might yet be recovered.
I made a lot of money for them. I was making 20% return for them doing arbitrage for years. All the A&B clients, all of my friends, everybody else. You know, it was the people that came in very late in the game that got hurt. I'm sure, I'm confident that when this thing is all finished, very few people, if any, will lose their principle.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, it's not, it doesn't make it right.
Bernie Madoff spinning from jail. Now, Diana Henriquez points out that many people may indeed get back a good chunk of their principal, what they put in. Of course, there's been a lot of mayhem along the way. Diana, we've got one of Bernie Madoff's victims with us this hour. If you can stand by for just a second in New York, joining us right now from Phoenix, Arizona, is Ronnie Sue Ambrosino. Originally from New York, was traveling with her husband in an RV when they learned about Madoff's arrest. Literally had to pull off the road and start a new life right there where they were. They had lost everything they saved. She joins us today from Phoenix. Ronnie Sue Ambrosino, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We're all hearing now Bernie Madoff, you know, speaking from prison, giving his take on what's going on. Diana has brought us that and a lot more. What do you think of Bernie Madoff today, his circumstances today? Are you satisfied with his punishment, Ronnie Sue?
Well, you know, the punishment, yes. For the 150 years, yes, I'm very happy with that. I don't think that we have everybody involved in the crime in jail. First of all, we have Frank DiPasquale, who has confessed to it, is still walking the streets, and Annette Bongiorno. You know, we have, this is a very, very, very complex situation. And it's really for the victims. In our group, the Madoff Victims Coalition, it's not about Bernie Madoff anymore.
What's it about?
It's about our recovery. It's about our SIPC insurance that we are being denied. And it's about a government regulatory system that's failed us. It's failed us, and it's failing every victim.
Let me be sure I understand.
We hear that. Mm-hmm. Excuse me?
I just want to be sure. First of all, I want to make clear, you are the coordinator of this Madoff Victims Coalition. You've got about 450 members. I thought, Ronnie Sue, that you had gotten, I don't know, all or a good chunk of your money back from the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Is that not true?
That's not true. I haven't, nor have 85% of the victims. And what's happening is this protection was made to give investors security and confidence in our marketing system.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, we invested with an SEC-regulated broker,
yep,
and an SEC-approved broker. And now that we found that there's fraud, this SIPC protection is being denied us. It's contrary to what Congress wanted when it was created. It's contrary to prior legal cases that have happened. And what's happening is the trustee is pronouncing through a very well-established PR campaign that he's collecting all this money for victims. And he is. However, he forgets to tell people that he's collecting it for less than 15% of the victims.
Why is that?
Well, it's a very complex situation, but the victims are supposed to be paid up to $500,000 based on the amount of money that they had at the time the fraud was discovered. So think about somebody who invested 30 years ago. Let's say he put $10,000 in Madoff's account.
Yep.
Right or wrong, when Madoff was arrested, he thought he had $100,000.
Right.
He should be paid up to $500,000. So in this case, he would get $100,000 according to the CIPIC statute.
So not just the principal, but the return that they thought they would get. Picard is out there. He's working on that. Are you confident you're going to get your principal back?
If legal system prevails, if justice prevails, yes. Okay? Right now, we have an appeal going because we believe that Mr. Picard has erroneously defined how he's paying the victims. It's never happened this way in the past, and he just arbitrarily came up with what I call the Picardian theory.
How's life in Phoenix?
It's not based on law, and it's not based on fact, and it's not based on precedent.
Ronnie Sue, have you started a new life in Phoenix? I mean, did you really, like, go bust over the Madoff scam?
Did I really what?
Did you really go broke out of the Madoff scandal? Have you started a new life in Phoenix?
Well, I certainly wouldn't make up the fact that I went broke. That's not something that you want to aspire to in life.
No.
Yes, I did. My husband and I had saved, and we did retire in order to have a wonderful life together. And we tried to save as much money as possible in our Madoff account and withdraw as little as possible so that we would have a future. We're fairly young, and we wanted to have a secure financial future. And we're fortunate that we are young, we're physically capable, we are kind of resilient, and we've had to pick up the pieces and start over. You know, you have two options. You can either crawl into a hole or you can pick yourself up by the bootstraps, and we've opted to do the latter.
Ronnie Sue Ambrosino joining us from Phoenix, Arizona, 58 years old, Madoff victim along with her husband. Ronnie Sue, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Diana Henriquez, what do you make of that story? And what about her, two things. She doesn't just want her principal back. She wants, you know, what she thought she had on paper. And you heard her say that she thinks the bankruptcy trustee will only pay out to maybe 15% of those who were in with Madoff?
Well, the numbers are a little different than that. There were about 4,900 accounts, direct accounts with Bernie Madoff, and roughly half of those people were what are sadly called net winners, like Ronnie Sue, people who actually have gotten their principal back because they withdrew it as earnings on their investments over the years. And so she has gotten her principal back.
But she doesn't feel whole.
Mm-hmm. Of course not. Of course she doesn't feel whole because she didn't get what was on paper.
Right.
And the battle here is actually much simpler than it sounded. It's simply, which do the courts honor? Do the courts honor the final statement from this Ponzi scheme that said you had actually a balance that totaled $65 billion?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you have, at best, what you put into the Ponzi scheme? Can we get that back out to you, back in your hands? Now, the trustee's effort, and it's disputed, she's absolutely right, it is fiercely disputed, but the trustee's effort is to get everybody initially onto the same playing field so that here's this one group of victims, about half of them, who did get their principal back. True, they lost their imaginary profits, but they got their principal back.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this other half of the people who didn't get any of their principal back yet. And those are the folks, the so-called net losers that we don't hear from very often, who are hoping that Picard can at least put them on the same footing as Ronnie Sue, where they will at least have gotten back out what they initially put in.
Mm.
Now, if Picard is extraordinarily successful, he may actually be able to do that, to get all of those net losers back on the same playing field that Ronnie Sue is on. And then if there's more money he can get by suing these big international banks for damages, and he sued one major group of defendants for civil racketeering seeking triple damages.
Hmm.
If he can recover more than $20 billion, Tom, then everybody, Ronnie Sue and the net losers, will have a fraud claim against the estate that may produce an additional payment for them. That's going to be years down the road and a couple of important court decisions yet to come. The legal fallout from the Madoff case is really going to stay with us for a long, long time. And Ronnie Sue is right that it's an important legal issue. It's up on federal appeal in Manhattan right now. My guess is it's probably headed to the Supreme Court, because whichever side loses is going to try to get the Supreme Court to hear it. So we're nowhere close to the finish line on these difficult legal issues that she outlined.
Let's get a call from Brookline, Massachusetts, and Peter. Hi, Peter. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Throughout this whole disaster, we only hear that Bernie Madoff himself was behind this, but it seems that he would need even a small army of people to logistically carry this out. That is, fake thousands of monthly or quarterly statements,
yep,
mail them out, cut checks to people who want redemptions, yet we never hear anything about that. I'm very curious about that.
Let's do it right now. Peter, thanks for your call. Diana, how How did he pull this off? And what about the number of people that it took to do it? Who knew?
Well, actually, the number of people who have already confessed, besides Bernie himself, are his key henchman, his key lieutenant, Frank DePascali, who really masterminded a lot of the deceptive tactics that Bernie Madoff used to conceal this crime.
Is he not in jail, as Ronnie Sue says?
He is facing a 125-year sentence. However, he has been released on bail pending sentencing while he is cooperating with the prosecutors. Okay. And it is based on his testimony mm-hmm. that five other employees of the Madoff firm have been indicted. They insist they are innocent. They will go to trial later this year. But it is based on DePascali's cooperation that those indictments have been brought. Another figure has pleaded guilty. That is the supposedly independent auditor who audited the Madoff firm. He pleaded guilty and is again cooperating with prosecutors and is out on bail pending his sentencing later this year.
Could a half dozen people do all this, put out all those thousands of statements? I mean, how?
As I describe in The Wizard of Lies, and I think people will find this fairly revealing because it isn't something we were really able to get our arms around when we were trying to report it from day to day, is the elaborate Potemkin village of software, computer software and equipment that Madoff and DePascali created to facilitate this crime. It's almost ironic, Tom. Madoff automated his legitimate firm and made it really the hallmark of technology on Wall Street. He automated his Ponzi scheme, too. He developed software programs that allowed him to change customer accounts with a couple of keystrokes. He had one software program that allowed him to create a fictional screen that made it look like you were looking into Wall Street Central Clearinghouse, and there were all your stocks safe and sound, and it was really just a fake. He had a software program that would allow Frank DePascali to look like he was doing trades with Europe for your account. He was really just trading keystrokes with a guy in a room down the hall. So, yes, there was a lot of work to be done, and there was a small body of people on the 17th floor who carried out the paperwork. Their defense lawyers say they had no idea that the orders they were following were part of this elaborate fraud. Will be settled in court.
People who should have spoken up allegedly had a pretty good idea what might be going on here. I mean, there's this the bankruptcy trustee, again, Irving Picard, has filed this lawsuit. You've reported on it, seeking $6.4 billion in damages, fees, profits from J.P. Morgan Chase, a bankruptcy court filing that three of the current members of J.P. Morgan Chase's executive committee had talked about as early as June of 2007, the possibility that Madoff was running a Ponzi scheme. They didn't take any action to protect investors or alert regulators. Of course, they say that the whole accusation is patently false, but I'm looking at your reporting here, Diana. You're talking about a high-level J.P. Morgan official talking about the agenda from a meeting where they talked about this and saying that this discussion should never see the light of day again. Did J.P. Morgan Chase, did other big banks know what was going on?
Well, they claim, as you note, that they didn't. But I think we have to put ourselves in a little context here. Did they suspect, did bankers at all levels and hedge fund managers suspect that Madoff was cutting corners and bending the rules? I think they probably did. But then, remember the times. Everybody was. It was a shabby, shabby time on Wall Street. And in some ways, Madoff may have looked more honest than others. That would not have automatically suggested to everyone that because he's cutting corners, because he's bending rules, he must be running a gigantic Ponzi scheme.
You know, I've heard you say everybody was cutting corners then, but I mean, you were one of the reporters on the beat. This isn't something we can tolerate, is it? I mean, look what's happened to the country and investors in the aftermath of this whole epical meltdown. It's not something we can just say, well, that's human nature. But you almost do in your book, as I read you, Diana.
I appreciate your point of view, but when you say this isn't something we can tolerate, we didn't just tolerate it, Tom. We decided this is how we wanted to do it.
What do you mean?
Over 20 years, this country decided that deregulating markets and cutting back on stiff market regulation mm-hmm. and cutting back on the budget at the SEC and tolerating a very high level of turnover at the SEC because salaries were too low, that was healthy. that that was good, that markets would somehow regulate themselves. And that, you can go back 20 years and watch that process start. I document in the book that slow deterioration of the regulatory machinery over the years that we were sold as the best thing for capitalism. We need to be globally competitive. We need to regulate with a light touch. We need to cut budgets. We need to keep everybody on a lean diet.
Has that been fixed?
And
has
we
that
all
been
believed
changed?
In that.
Has it been changed?
Oh, there's a lot of rhetoric that it will be. And yet as soon as the deficit reduction arguments began in Washington, you saw the SEC's budget right there on the chopping block again. So we are giving lip service to it. I will be very interested to see if, in fact, the commitments to tougher regulation are carried out. But I think we're going to get the level of regulation that we demand. And you must remember, for many years, we weren't demanding it. Let's talk about hedge funds, for example, of that. The SEC only lightly regulated hedge funds for years, and if Bernie Madoff's secret business was anything, it was a secret hedge fund, an unregistered hedge fund. Nobody wanted the SEC to regulate hedge funds, and yet lots of middle-class investors wanted to invest in them.
Diana Henrique says, watch out. I think you're saying, Diana, it could happen again. It may be happening again right now.
Could be.
Diana Henriquez, listen, thanks for your reporting on this book. It's really an interesting tale fully told here, and we appreciate your time today. Thank you so much, Diana.
Thank you, Tom.
Diana Henriquez's new book is The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.